أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. وأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. والذين جاهدوا فينا لنهدينهم سبلنا وإن الله لمع المحسنين. صدق الله العلي العظيم. اللهم صل على Last night's discussion on the arrival of the month of Muharram was a standalone discussion. And tonight, inshallah, we'll begin our content and our topic for this ashra. As was announced, the topic that inshallah I will be covering in this ashra will be the cultivation of an Islamic identity in a postmodern era. It's a fancy title to talk about identity, essentially. Before I get into a little bit of the muqaddamat and the preliminary discussions tonight, I do want to speak a little bit about the importance of these days and delivering the right message. There's a very powerful hadith by Imam Jawad alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala. And I want all of you to understand this hadith line by line. Inshallah, I'll break it down for all of you as we do venture into these days where there's a lot of choice now in terms of speakers in this city online. Let's keep this hadith in mind when we do actually venture out and give our time to various speakers. The hadith says, "Man asgha ila natiqan faqad abadahu." For the one now who does asgha, for lack of a better translation, is the one who listens attentively and attempts to follow what he or she has heard. Ila natiqan, from the natiq. Natiq, of course, here means a speaker. The one who listens and follows a speaker, faqad abadahu, becomes the servant or slave of that speaker. Now, of course, I'm not talking about worshipping that speaker, but I'm talking about impact. I'm talking about the fact that there is influence there from a speaker. The hadith goes on very dangerously now. Imam Jawad breaks down the various different levels. He says, فَإِن كَانَ نَاطِقًا عَنِ اللَّهِ فَقَدْ عَبَدَ اللَّهِ. If the natiq, if the speaker now speaks from Allah, for Allah, on behalf of Allah, takes the audience and the awam and the majma towards Allah, faqad abad Allah, they become the slaves of Allah. Wa in kana natiqan yantiqu ila lisan iblis faqad abada iblis. But if that speaker, if that natiq speaks from the lisan of iblis, from the tongue and the lahja of shaitan, presents satanic concepts on this member, meant to divide the nation, destroy homes, cut the knees of another speaker or an alim, go against the maraji, basically satanic concepts, then the people who are listening to them, who does what? Remember, man asgha. There are a lot of people, a lot of us, who not only follow lectures, but we follow certain individuals. And after a while, we begin to worship them like idols. that whatever they say is hujjat upon us for some reason. Whether it goes against a certain, you know, concept in Islam or not, but the hadith is very dangerous. If that natiq, if that speaker is speaking in a satanic lahja, in a satanic tone, then the audience, faqad abada iblis, becomes the slave of iblis. It's dangerous. I have my rights that all of you have to give me as my audience to sit quietly, listen to me, which you do always at Masumin. But one thing I don't think is ever mentioned is that you also have rights as the listener, as the one who now takes time out of their day. There are some couples here tonight who have brought in their newborn baby in a car seat. You know how hard that is to get them ready to leave, to pack the bags? You bring children now, they get home by, you know, by the time I get home, it'll be midnight. My kids were fast asleep in the car last night. It is a sacrifice. It's a movement. It's not easy. Now, for you to come and listen to satanic concepts on the minbar is injustice done to you as the awam and the speaker. Which means that you also have to ensure the rights that you have are upheld by the one sitting on this very minbar. Because, you know, this is, you know, in the world of Arabic grammar, a mimbar is an Arabic word that is ismi makan. It is a place where we should be gaining elevation. It's a place of bulandi, as they say in Urdu. Which is why when you look at the way that our fourth imam now directs and addresses Yazid in his own courtyard, he never refers to what he's sitting on as a mimbar. Takhte chubi, he says, as you say in Farsi. It's a wooden plank this man is sitting on, because there's no way what he's sitting on is a mimbar of Rasul. There's no bulandi and there's no elevation coming from someone like that. I say that not because I belong up here. Of course I don't. I say that because these 10 nights have to deliver a message that puts out the fires right now inside of our homes. Not to further fuel them. To address those issues that are mubtala bih, as they say, that are directly hitting our homes, our community, our ummah at large. And unfortunately, I only have 10 days. And there is an umpteen amount of issues to talk about. It's my discretion as a speaker now to figure out what is it that I need to address. And one thing that has come to my attention for many, many years is this crisis of an identity. You ask my elders, where are you from? What are you? Who are you? Right away the answer is there. You ask these kids, where are you from? They'll say, what do you want to know? My parents? Where I was born? Where I grew up? What language I know? Right? 10 more questions follow that. So it is the job of the speaker on the pulpit now to ensure that those issues are addressed. Otherwise, there's no point, I'm sorry. And I mentioned that because you might think, well, this is obvious, Asad Bhai. It's not so obvious anymore. As I mentioned last night, kind of indirectly, there are still some people who come and approach me directly when they see the flyers and my topic and all these things, then why are you talking about these things in the first 10 days? You have the whole year for that. Leave the first 10 days for Imam Hussein. Just talk about Imam Hussein. Talk about Abul Fazl. Talk about Ali Akbar. What's the point of commemorating a man who gave his life for the deen if we don't talk about that very deen? And so this is a massive topic, and one that I think that we have to identify. Islam has its own identity. And the problem is that our youth are not sold on that identity. And so they are looking now to be accepted and attach themselves to something where now they feel like they belong. Remember, inside the psyche of the human being, inside the innate nature of the human being, is a sense of belongingness. They need to belong to something. This tribalism that we've seen from the Prophet's time, even today, is very innate. Right? The example I used to always give, I still give that example, is that in my first 6-7 months in Qom, they teach you the language. They take you to a school of linguistics, and they teach you Farsi. And you're in that school now of 300 plus people, and they're all non-Iranians of 90 plus countries. I remember my classes would be 50 minutes in length, and there would be a 10-minute break. And during that 10-minute break, we go down and grab a cup of chai. There's a little canteen and shop there. It's incredible to see as the students will come down in the basement where there's a shop there, they would automatically gravitate towards those people who are from their country, who spoke their language. And within seconds now, the thing that the school is trying to avoid is that you'd have their groups. The Arabs would be in one corner, us English guys in one corner, us the Americans, the UK guys, right? You have the Pakistanis in one corner, and they're all speaking nothing. They're all speaking every language but Farsi. It would drive them crazy. Speak Farsi, they would scream at us. But that is innate. My father would tell me in the 70s, right, that they would be, you know, going in the grocery shop. If they see anybody who is, you know, relatively brown in color, they would stop and have a chit-chat with them. Kahan ke hai? What's going on? What's your name? Right? It was a surprise now that you see somebody of someone like your color in the grocery shop. Now, if you see a white guy, you're shocked nowadays. But that's what it is. It is an innate gravitational pull. Allah says we did that, right? Inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha. Wa ja'alnakum shu'uban wa qabaila. We placed you in tribes. It's fitri now to belong to each other, right? It's fitri now to have this sense of belongingness. And the moment that the youth of today feel like they don't belong to a community, to a family, to an identity, they'll go out shopping for something else. I always talk about this in my tarbiyat classes whenever I talk about bringing up children. If you want your kids to be attached inside your home, it's not my topic, but very briefly, if you want them to stay at home and be invested in that family, make them feel like they belong in that family. How do I do that? You acknowledge their existence. We have some parents, unfortunately, that the moment that a child begins to talk, they get cut off, they get shushed. Tum bas khamosh raho, tum chote ho. You have no idea what's going on. You're young. You know, meanwhile, he's a 21-year-old grown man, full beard. What do you know? Tum to bachi ho, you have no idea. And right away, khamosh, khamosh, quiet, 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 silence, silence. And automatically now, he feels like, I don't belong in this tribe. And so they go around shopping for different tribes. And sometimes I tell you, the best of your kids belong to the worst of the groups. Because I know they're wrong, I know they're bad, Asad Bhai, but they make me feel like I belong to them. The moment you identify with anybody, you attach yourself to that. And that comes from an innate nature to be known. We want to be known. The moment somebody doesn't acknowledge my presence is the moment that I feel like I'm invisible. The worst thing you could do to anybody, be it your own child, is make them feel invisible in front of you. They're talking, no one's listening. They walk into this hall, they say salam to every single person, they avoid you. The second person comes, doesn't say salam to you. The third doesn't, everyone else they say salam to, but they walk right past you. After all, you have to say, hello, am I invisible? Do you not see me? So this is a crisis right now. I don't think a lot of our youth feel like they belong to the tribe of Islam. They identify with Islam. Because with identity comes a lot of beautiful characteristics. One of them is pride. There's nothing more beautiful for me than to see a young kid, 10, 12, 13, 15, that's proud to be a Muslim. That stops and says, no, my name is Muhammad, not Muhammad. It's Ali, not Ali. You can do it. Say it with me. Oh, I tried very hard to get Asad. I got Assad, I'll take that. But Assad, I couldn't take. No, say it properly. That's all part of the pride factor. Because the flip side is that if you don't identify with the deen, then any remnant of the deen inside of you, from the physical hijab, to the beard, to the name on your business card, all will not resemble Islam. We run from that as far as possible. This is a crisis we're facing right now. And so naturally now, right, if you don't feel like you belong to the deen, you're not going to follow its tenets, you're not going to worship that God, you're just going to you go through the motions until one day and someday when you become an adult and you say, you know what, I'm denouncing my religion. I get too many phone calls that my kid told me I'm agnostic, I'm an atheist now, Malana. Apne Shia log, in this GTA, can you come and talk to them? And I go to their house, I talk to them, and I tell them, please, you know, tell me about your atheism. It sounds intriguing. Convert me to be an atheist. And there's nothing there. It's hollow. They just don't want to be Muslim, so the next best option is a freedom-seeking atheist. No worship, no accountability, no God. Sounds pretty good to them. It's a crisis. And we have to now dissect this across 10 nights. Lots to talk about. Oh my God, lots to talk about. But let's start off with history. I've learned to realize the hard way that history is very important in everything and every topic in the deen. There are people out there that are master historians. I was never like that. In class, in the Hausa, it was that tariq class that I would run from. I found it dry, I found it boring, but I realized over some time that history has a funny way of repeating itself. If we learn of those previous to us, we can avoid a lot of mistakes right now. Let's examine a little bit of the mission of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. When the Holy Prophet attempted now to implement Islam in Mecca, the misconception was that he was looking to convert the entire region. Okay. The misconception still is, because I've had these talks with a lot of these youth, that there is this compulsion in religion. That they take on this Taliban, Daesh, ISIS mentality, either you're with us or we will behead you. And they take this ugly brush and they paint it with the entire deen of Islam today. And it becomes a very black and white, on and off, one and zero binary deen. It's not what the Prophet was all about. The Prophet was a part of this pre-Islamic Arabian peninsula, Arabian civilization, Arabian environment. And he did three things that are very crucial for us to understand. Now let me say one thing here while I'm here. I'm bound to upset my elders in this ashram, and I don't want to do that. I love all of you. But the reality is that identity is a compound discussion. Meaning what? There's multiple factors that help us identify who we are. Part of it is where we live. So the term Canadian Muslim that drives some of our elders a little bit mad, it's not a blasphemous term. Now you can, to make yourself feel better, no, bolo Muslim Canadian, fine, no problem. You can put Islam first, no problem. Where you put the dash is up to you. But where I'm headed in terms of this historical discussion, because by the way, the Quran also invites us to study those before us. فَصِيرٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُ كَيْفَ كَانَ عَقِبَةُ الْمُكَذِّبِينَ. Travel the earth. Do sayr of the land, as you say in Urdu. Do sayr, travel the land. فَانْظُرُ, look. Look, meaning ponder. What is the aqibat? What is the ultimate destiny of those who have denied Allah? Study their lives. Where did they go wrong? What happened? Where was the misguidance? How could it be? If you study Fir'aun himself, it is an intriguing study. This was a man who didn't deny God. He did not deny God. He believed in a higher power for sure, but he believed in a God of other gods. He believed in God to be the Sarparast, the God of the heavens. But this everyday Zamini God is people like me. I'm the God of Egypt. That God doesn't have time to come down and do these small little, you know, minute things. I'm in charge of you guys now. But absolutely. And you see that all throughout the story of Nabi Musa leading up to his drowning. There were moments of softness Fir'aun had, but he had horrible advisors that would whisper in his ear and bring him back to his corrupt ways. Letter number 31 in Nahj al-Balagha, beautiful letter written by Imam Ali to his son Imam Mujtaba. Beautiful. Paragraphs and paragraphs of nothing but treasures. Advice that you and I could really change our life on today. In that very same letter now, he says, study the lives of those before you. And he gives his own example. I studied civilizations before me to the point where it felt like I walked with them through their ruins. I was there in their successes. I grieved in their deficiencies. Why? It's important to pick up signs before the actual misguidance happens. So it's important that we understand this history. Now, very, very briefly, the Prophet came and had adopted three principles. Because not everything in the Jahiliyyah era, he threw out the window. No. Didn't reject everything. There were certain principles and certain cultural norms inside of Arabia that either he accepted and used for the betterment of Islam, number one. Number two, he either redirected towards God, or number three, outright rejected. I'll give you examples. The outright rejection, of course, were things like burying daughters alive. There was no compromise there. You can't use that for any betterment or any goodness. No. He replaces that now with this Surah An-Nisa that elevates women inside of Islam. Easy example. Where he would redirect the focus was on this tribalism, this loyalty towards your tribe. During that pre-Islamic era, you lived and died by your tribe. You were known by your tribe. This loyalty towards your tribe was unbelievable. If one person of that tribe was disrespected or killed, the entire tribe would go and avenge that. You were known not by your name, not even by your father's name sometimes. Which tribe do you belong to? And they would apply a certain stigma to you based on that of the tribe. That's incredible. The Prophet says, take that loyalty now instead of the tribe now and come to the tribe of God. The exact same loyalty, redirect towards God. And the final one that he actually used for the benefit, one example is, the Arabs back then, even today, have an immensely strong memory. Their hafizah was very qawi and very strong back then. And he used that for the Quran. A wahi would come down, the Prophet would summon two different groups of 10 people each. Those who would do hifz of the verse, those who would write down the verse. He would teach the verse to the 10 hafidhin, say, look, memorize it, repeat it back to me, make sure your arab is right, go back and teach others. He would also explain the ta'wil and tafsir of every verse, go back and use that memory of yours to store that verse in your mind. On the flip side, he'd say, make sure you write down the verse properly. Why is that important? Because after his death, when there's a whole discussion in Ulum al-Quran that I don't want to get into, about the compilation of the Quran, there is a massive difference of opinion. Some say the Quran was compiled already. Others say, no, Imam Ali, 6 months after the death of the Prophet, sat in his home and compiled it in the order of the nuzul of the Quran. This whole idea that Shias have their own Quran comes from this concept. I don't want to go down that route. I'll really go on a tangent. I don't want to do that. Enough to know that when there were individuals who wanted to do a little bit of tahrif, a little bit of distortion of the Quran, add some surahs, take some out, it was these individuals who did hifz of the Quran that would come and say, look, I was mawjood there when this wahi came down. This was not a surah of the Quran. This was a hadith by the Holy Prophet. This was not a hadith. This was a surah. For example, Surah Falak and Surah An-Nas. One group had said these are nothing but du'as against black magic. They're not surahs of the Quran. It was these Arabs who used their memory to say, no, absolutely this is a standalone surah. So the pride by which we say that our Quran was never ever distorted, not one fi, not one an was removed or added, part of it comes from the idea that the Prophet used this memory of theirs for the betterment of Islam. My point is, this wasn't an arrival of Islam, let's wipe the slate clean. Everyone who believes in everything, that's wrong, this is wrong, let's start fresh. No. He did his best to integrate into an existing community and present an option and present another avenue, another sabir, another path of which you can attain success in. I say that because sometimes I think our job in the West is to convert the entire street we live on. No, it's not. The tolerance of which Islam preaches is incredible. And that's where I think a lot of my youth don't understand this idea of identity. Identity is not simply to reject everything around you. Not everything in the West is to be thrown out or cursed. There's a lot of beauty in this part of the world that can really help Islam grow. So we have to apply the exact same principles here. There are principles where we live, doesn't matter where you live, in the East or the West, that either we reject or we redirect or we use. It's all part of identity building. I'll give you a few examples. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I swear time goes faster in Brampton for some reason. I don't know why. I can't believe it's been half an hour already. I'm not even past my intro yet. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. A few examples. Number one was his migration to Medina. There were existing Jewish tribes there. The Prophet never came in and said, you are to convert to Islam or lose your life. Absolutely not. The beautiful system of the jizya in Islam is a beautiful discussion. One day, someday, we'll have it. The tolerance by which this system now presents itself to other faiths is a lesson for you and I. Please, I ask my youth out there, and so many of you right now are in front of me, and when I pull in to the driveway, I see these guys in the back with their yellow jackets. My salams to you. It's incredible to see this young blood now serving this community. Incredible. But I also know this, that when it comes to Islam, there is some trauma. I have some young guys telling me when they find their voice and they find their himmat and they find their boldness, they tell me, look, I'll be very honest, Sayyid, when it comes to Islam, anything to do with Islam, namaz, fasting, the masjid, mosque, muharram, whatever you name it, I have this pit in my stomach. I have anxiety. You talk about the grave and death, forget it, I'm out. I'll leave the actual hall. You talk about hijab, I'll put my fingers in my ears, true story, until you're done talking about hijab. Where is that coming from? And yeah, they'll tell me. I had, let's say, for example, a horrible experience growing up when it comes to religion. I had a horrible dinyat Sunday school teacher who just got mad at me because I couldn't figure out which namazes were wajib and which were not. I asked a scholar one day years ago a question and I got him on a bad day. He was a cranky scholar. And he snapped at me. I thought, oh, forget it. I'll never ask a scholar another question again. I enter those doors. I get some auntie now judging me, some uncle judging me, asking me 1,000 questions, fixing my hijab, telling me my beard is too long, my jeans are too tight. Forget it. All these things are there. I'm always told, for example, that the hellfire and the squeezing of the grave and the punishment, right? I've been told since I am a child of a God of fear, a God of fear, a God of fear. God was the boogeyman inside of my house. God was the bad cop inside of my house. If you don't do this, God will do this to you. That's my picture of Islam. Now at 23, you want me to submit to this? I'm sorry. All legitimate, by the way. Some people might think, oh, boo-hoo, you're coddling today's youth. I'm not. I think those are legitimate discussions. But my question to you is, you're not 9 years old anymore. This is not grade 4 dinyat. You're 23 years old. If you want to erase all that, you can. How? Seek. Seek out the religion. A statement I mentioned at Al-Mahdi about a couple hours ago, seekers will seek. And the deen is a deen to be sought after. And the amount of things that are there for all of you now to capture and grab and rebuild your deen is incredible. Never happened when I was your age in this city. My father would tell me that, you know, we had so many questions about the deen, there was no avenue to ask. If I asked one or two questions to an alim, they would summon my father. It's kutamisa kawya. How dare he ask me a question? Baba, he is curious. No. Now, anywhere, everywhere, picking up food at Costco, I get stopped. True story. I love it, by the way. I was looking at some cantaloupe, and I had a tap on my shoulder, and they asked me, "Are you?" I said, "Jeffrey, yes, I am. I have a. This is what I love. This. I have a small question." I said, "Okay. I have a or halka sawal, as they say, halka. It's all. And these are discussions about, like, you know, free will and predestination and things that require an ashra of majalis. I'm like, look, let's pick out the cantaloupe and we'll discuss as we go towards the cashews and the almonds, inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So it's important that we understand that if you are now somebody in this hall right now, online, out in the in the women's hall, that has this trauma, I get it. I'm not downplaying that at all. But fix it now. Some ulama out there right now are doing incredible work with incredible organizations, putting together packages of durus and animations and podcasts. I mean, incredible work that I benefit from. Now there's no reason that you can't remove that pit out of your stomach. So the first example is the example of arriving in Medina. He doesn't say to the Jewish tribes, convert, convert. No, he doesn't. Last week we had the Jashin of Mubahila. Not sure if you had a program here, but if you read the history of this event, it is an incredible history, filled with lessons. To me, the most beautiful lesson, one of them at least, is the way that the Prophet welcomed the Christians of Najran. To the point where even some ashab were saying, "Are you sure, Ya Rasulullah?" They came, they said, "Look, we don't have a place to stay here in Medina, and we need a place to worship our God." And the Prophet gave them his mosque to worship. Come in, you can stay here at the mosque, you can worship. And they worshipped in their own way. And there was no one there. The companions would come and say, "Ya Rasul, these are Christians in our mosque." No problem. You talk about things like, for example, the example of Imam Khomeini, who was in France, exiled to France. They say that, you know, one year it was the Eid of Adha, Eid al-Qurban, and his companions now, or, you know, those who are with him now, had said to him, "Agha, let's sacrifice an animal in the backyard here where you're staying." It was against the law in France to do that without some sort of permit or some permission. And right away, Imam Khomeini says, "No, it's against the law here in France. I'm trying to build a few." You know, you guys have heard my ashras enough to know the first one or two or three lectures are all sort of, you know, the idea of, you know, discovering some concepts, discussing some really dry material, which I'll use later on in my 7th, 8th, and 9th majlis, which really is my thesis and crux of my ashra. So bear with me in these next few nights. It's important that we lay out this foundation so I can build on that foundation. Imam Khomeini says, "No. There is a whole respect of the law of the land that the fiqh has." If that wasn't enough, we talk about the idea that the Prophet not only gave his mosque for worship, but he gave them to stay there as well. One thing that I think gets lost in the event of Mubahila, and I'll move on from Mubahila, is that the aftermath of Mubahila, that treaty that they signed was an incredible treaty. A beautiful, that simply isn't discussed enough. That was broken later on, post-Prophet of Allah, by the second Khalifa. It was broken by him. But the Prophet had said, "Look, these are people who will live, they'll pay the tax, and we are in charge of their security. Nobody is to hurt them. No one is to attack them. They can worship as they wish. My point is, Islam was never about an all or nothing mentality. Islam never said to arrive in a certain location and convert the entire world. I think sometimes we have that same notion when it comes to Imam Zamana, that he's going to come and convert everyone to Shia. Pura jahan jo Shia. No, that's not how it's going to work. I'm sorry. The very role of Nabi Isa is to go and work with the Christians to revive the asl teachings of the deen. My point is, an Islamic identity is a tolerant identity, an accepting identity, one that works with other faiths. If a Hindu couple married already while they're a Hindu convert to Islam as a couple, and now the husband and the wife enter Islam together, nowhere does any marja, no fiqhi ruling says that a nikah now has to happen all over again. No, Islam respects the fact that they, in their own Hindu culture and Hindu religion, were married, will accept that marriage. Now you are a married Muslim couple. No need for ankahtu, qabiltu, not at all. Don't need that. That's the level of respect Islam has for other religions, other faiths, all that. I think sometimes when it comes to identity, we believe it's reject all and accept this. And that's just not something that's practical. And it was never the case. You look at the imams, the open door policy of the fifth and sixth imam, the golden age of Shiism, all sorts of people came to their doors. Atheists, Shias, Sunnis, Jews, Christians, agnostic, everybody. Name me once where the imam slammed the door in anyone's face. Didn't happen. There are some that would come to ridicule, challenge, attempt to teach the imams. He would, of course, put up with that. He would entertain this individual. People claiming to be God would entertain this idea. Islam is a very tolerant religion. Unfortunately, it's been hijacked. In a post 9/11 world, it has been. In the process now, a 16, 17, 18 year old has gone lost. Because they don't want to be the ambassador of the religion. They don't want to be the one who defends this group and that group in their schools, and online, at their workplace. So it's better that they kind of ease away from that. That's why this whole discussion of assimilation and integration and, you know, all this, Islam was never about the idea of being somebody who rejects everything else and simply holds on to their culture. On the flip side, also Islam says, now hold on, don't assimilate to the point where we have no idea whether you are Muslim or not. That also is an extreme. And we've seen that many times in this West. So the opening discussion on this topic of identities, understand why did Islam come? How was it established? It was never meant to be an all or nothing system, which means that you can live in an un-Islamic society and still hold on to an Islamic identity. If there are values and cultural norms in this part of the world that is going to promote and further progress your deen, then absolutely hold on to them and use them. You go to the hospitals nowadays, you see the amount of humanity there is there in saving one life. I gave the example before. Thousands of dollars are being spent to save one life. And when that life is saved, there's a celebration like all of humanity has been saved. And I'm sorry, sometimes you don't see that in the East, in these Muslim countries. Because of course they're immune or desensitized towards death. They see it so many times. War-torn countries, martyrdoms, revolutions. So death to them is not a big deal. But here, for example, oh, they'll exhaust all options. It reminds me of the verse that you save one, you save humanity. So that's a very Islamic concept, right? My point is that there's good everywhere. The identity part is to preserve your Islam by still being a part of that society. That balance has not been struck yet inside of our youth. Because they're not sold on the first part yet. I want to sell you all, sell myself on the first part in these 10 nights. To understand how can I cultivate that identity. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And as we move forward now, you know, we'll build on these discussions. We'll talk about the idea that the identity is a mind, body, and soul discussion. That's a crucial one. We'll talk about the barriers. Why is it that today's youth are not proud to be Muslims? Now, I'm not saying everybody, a general statement. But it seems as if there is this lack of pride. To my elders, that they had this pride. You know, and I'm the first one to sit there and look at myself. I don't know why. Even when I was, I remember my, you know, there's one story I have, and I moved towards Messiah, mashallah. I'm not sure if I told the story here or not. I don't think I have. When I was, you know, working in my pre-Hausa days, I just started at a company. I think it was like a few months now. And it was just before the month of Ramadan. So I worked now in this company in the month of Ramadan. Now I went through, and then of course the day of Eid was announced, and I arrived at work on the day of Eid. I was just kind of, you know, I was scared, I was nervous, I didn't know if I should approach my boss, I didn't know how to say it's my Eid, what is Eid, do I call it Christmas, what do I do? So I just kind of, okay, just say, you know, like a normal day. So I walked into my work at 9 a.m. on the day of Eid. It was killing me. Because one thing I used to love growing up was going to the masjid. You know, we're all dressed up, me and my two brothers and my father, our musalla in our hands, and we would go, and it would be a beautiful, beautiful, in the old 7340 Bayview Avenue. I loved namaz there in that echoing dome. I used to love that moment. And that day I couldn't do it. And so I worked, you know, 9, 10, 2 hours in, my team leader, I'll never forget this man, his name was John, 6'6". There's only a few guys that I look up to like this in my life. He was one of them. He was a good man. He looked at me very, very, very frank. He says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm scheduled to work today. I mean, it's a Tuesday or Wednesday." He goes, "Isn't today your Eid?" "Eid." I said, "Yes, it is." He goes, "Why are you here? Can you go home, please? And why didn't you ask for the day off?" And right away, I felt like, why didn't I ask for the day off? And he asked me, he goes, "Do you think we would have said no to you? It's your right now. This is a big day for you." I mean, he actually had more pride in my belief than I did. He goes, "Go home, be with your family. Come back tomorrow. This stuff can wait. Don't worry about it. We'll cover your shift, blah, blah, blah." It was an eye, this was, I'm talking about 20 years ago. It was an eye-opening experience for me. And I feel like a lot of us have that similar situation. There's a little bit of this asasi kamtari, as I call it in Urdu. There's a little bit of inferiority complex that we have to come kind of fight over. To please a person that, I'm sorry, will never be pleased with us. Will always be the other to them. We can shave our beard, take off our hijab, change our names, put it in brackets on our business card, all we want, but we're still going to have this shade on our skin. And that day was a big day for me. I realized that. And so in this ashra, I want to break that inside of me, inside of all of you. Because really that's what Imam Hussein ultimately left the comforts of Medina for. Uphold these principles. As I mentioned now, the Hindu woman last night, the biggest difference between her and us is the fact that she'll cry, she'll grieve, she'll accept the fact that zulm happened, but that's the extent of it. Where you and I now continue is, we become the embodiment of that message of Imam Hussein. A reflection of it, a symbol of it, a reminder for others of it. Very crucial. And if we look at some moments in history, we understand that this was a very difficult sacrifice. The night of the 2nd of Muharram is upon us, and this is the night that Imam Hussein arrives in Karbala. Now, what I've read, you know, there are a couple of things that I find quite strange that Imam Hussein did at this moment. That later on, of course, it makes sense to me, but initially it didn't make sense to me. And that was that, first of all, when they arrived in Karbala, some sources say that the horse of Imam Hussein stopped on the plains of Karbala. Wouldn't move. Imam Hussein thought that, okay, this was a tired horse, let's change the horse. And some reports say that 6 to 7 different horses were changed. But none of them moved from the spot. These were very loyal horses, by the way, to Imam Hussein. They would never do anything that went against Imam Hussein's mission. I say that because the only other time that we have, that as far as I know, where the horse refused to move was on the day of Ashura. Imam Hussein now has said his khudafis, has done his al-wida with the women, which itself was very difficult. Is mounted on the horse by Zainab, about to now enter the Maidan of Karbala, but his horse would not move. And Imam Hussein thought that he was tired, and again he would speak to this beautiful animal, saying, "Look, I know you're tired. You've been with me from morning to now, carrying mayat after mayat, shaheed after shaheed. Just drop me in the middle of the Maidan of Karbala and you are free to go." But the horse still wouldn't move. "If you can just drop me in at a spot of shade, then you are free to go. I know you are tired." But the horse still wouldn't move. At that moment, now history says that the horse kind of bent down, almost to say, "Look, I'm not tired. I would serve you for as long as I could, but your four-year-old Sakina is clutching my leg, saying, 'Where are you taking my Baba? Where are you taking my Baba?'" The horse on the second of Muharram doesn't move. Imam Hussein gets off the horse now, summons the Bani Yassir tribe who owns that land, asking them one by one, "What is the name of this land? What's the name of this land?" And he hears all sorts of names. He hears Nainawa, Shatul Farat, but my Mullah was looking for a very specific name. He was looking for a very specific name. He kept asking. There was a buzurg from the back who would come forward and say, "Mola, our ajdad used to call this plain, this land, Karbala, a place of calamity and suffering." When Imam Hussein heard Karbala, "Abbas, pitch up the tents. Abbas, this is where my Ali Akbar will give his life. This is where my Qasim's body will be trampled. This is where my Abbas's arms will be separated." That's the moment where Bibi Zainab begins to cry here in Karbala. And this is where Imam Hussein does something very ajib to me. He calls the men of the Bani Yassir tribe, tells them, "Look, there's going to be a battle here. Make sure that when the battle is over, that you men bury us men. You men bury us men." And then he went so far to put up a partition, talk to the women. "If your men are not able to bury us, all of you women now, dig one massive grave and just place our bodies in that grave." Imam Hussein went one step further. He grabbed the small masoom children of the Bani Yassir tribe. He put them in his lap. He hugged them. He kissed them. "Are you Muslim?" "Yes, we are." "Do you recite the kalima?" "Yes, we do." "That Muhammad Rasulullah is my grandfather. I am Hussein, the son of Fatima. There's going to be a battle here. If your fathers and your mothers are not able to bury us, then you with your small masoom hands, pick up the khak of Karbala, drop it on our bodies." Why, Mola? So much intizam for burial. Why, Mola? When someone is buried in our community, there's no need for the loved ones to call anyone, say, "Look, make sure you bury my father, bury my mother, bury my spouse, bury my child." It's given. The news of death is given, and the team now begins their process. The ghusl is ready. The grave is dug. The qabristan is called. The alim is ready for talqeen. Everything now is ready. The last thing we want to do is deprive this mayat of its given right to be buried properly. But my Muslim imam knew that for 3 days he'll lay on that hot sand of Karbala, not even a kafan on his body. He knew that that moment would come where Imam Sajjad was about to leave towards Kufa, sitting there in front of his father, looking up to Bibi Zainab, his face changing. "Hey, puppy amma, just tell me one thing. Have you ever heard of a son leaving his father unburied on the plains of Karbala, like I'm leaving my Muslim father?" Mu'tamir Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein. Ya Hussein, Ya